This is the State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. Across North Carolina, we're still drying off from this weekend's drenching from Hurricanes Bonnie and Charlie. But weather forecasters are warning the worst may come later in the hurricane season. Now, if the next big hurricane strikes in the fall, some say it could have a significant impact on the November elections. In a race as tight as this year's presidential contest, every item in the news could affect the way people in North Carolina and elsewhere choose to cast their votes. In this season of elections, big and small, we're talking this hour about news and politics in North Carolina. Governor Easley's been signing bills. New polls are out with North Carolinians' opinions on everything from elections to the war. And tomorrow, there are runoffs. The polling places will be open. Among Republicans in two congressional districts, there are contests, and among Democrats, there's a runoff for State Superintendent of Public Instruction. Well, joining us to talk about all of this for a roundup and analysis of the news are Paul O'Connor, who's a columnist for the Winston-Salem Journal. Welcome back, Paul.
Linda, good to see you again.
And Mike Munger is back. He is chair of the Political Science Department at Duke University. Welcome back, Mike.
Great to be on the show.
And Ed Cohn is with us on the phone. He is a writer and, among other things, an opinion columnist for the Greensboro News and Record and author of the blog edcohn.com. And Ed Cohn is with us by phone from Greensboro. Hi, Ed.
Hey, how are y'all?
Okay. And we welcome your calls this hour. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. Well, before we jump right into the fray of politics, pure politics, we can't go much further without acknowledging the weather that came to North Carolina a couple of times in the past few weeks, three times. The first three hurricanes of the season came through. North Carolina was pretty much spared, but there are some who are suggesting that, you know, if these more hurricanes, disasters come later in the season, this could have an impact in a close race.
Well, it certainly did. And it was in 1996 when Governor Hunt was up for re-election and Robin Hayes was the Republican nominee. And it was almost as if Mr. Hayes didn't get any coverage from the day Fran hit until probably the last week of the election, because the news was all about the hurricane and the governor dominated the coverage of the hurricane and effectively shut out Mr. Hayes from getting much publicity and never getting any momentum to his campaign. So, yeah, it could happen again.
So hurricanes favor then the incumbent, Mike Munger?
Well,
because they get to go out there and give disaster assistance.
Some of that depends on how well things go. Snowstorms generally mean that the mayor is going to get fired because they can't possibly clean everything up. So the thing about Fran was that it happened September 5th or 6th, and right, there was enough time that it was cleaned up. If it happened closer to the election, it would be more. I have to say that this weekend reminded me of a presidential debate. We spent all this time waiting for storm and fury and wind, and nothing happened.
Yeah. Well, as one who had to batten down the hatches three times in 2 weeks, I was actually kind of happy that there was not 4 months of cleaning up to do, as was the case with Isabel.
I think one thing to keep in our memories is it 12 years ago now, when President Bush the first was running for re-election, there were a number of mishaps with how FEMA worked, Federal Emergency Management, and that became a real issue in the 92 campaign. And coming out of 92, the new President Clinton made a real effort to beef up emergency response. And I think that really helped Hunt in 96. But if I remember correctly, Andrew was early in the 92 campaign. Maybe it was earlier than that.
Hurricane Andrew in Florida.
Right. And there was this lingering dissatisfaction on Election Day with how emergency management had worked around the country, not just at Andrew, but
it was such a massive hurricane. That's not what happened this time in Florida. But if it's large enough, you just can't respond. But we all look for someone to blame, and whoever's the incumbent pays the price. So it could cut either way.
Right. Well, you know, there seems to be a never-ending tropical storm of campaign ads going on in the 5th Congressional District right now. Ed Cohn, that's near where you are and certainly where you write for Paul O'Connor with the Winston-Salem Journal. The 5th Congressional District is a runoff, a Republican runoff. It's between Vernon Robinson, and he's dubbed himself the Black Jesse Helms, and Virginia Fox, who's been a state senator. How would you call that race tomorrow, Ed Cohn?
Well, I don't have polling data, but I just read it in the Winston-Salem paper.
Good paper to be reading.
It'll be very interesting to see if people respond to yesterday's editorial in the Winston-Salem paper. I have not seen many editorials like that in my life where they just devastate a candidate. They said if Robinson wins, it could hand the district to the Democrats, even in such a safe Republican district, and that no representative for the 5th district would be better. It would be better to have no representative than to have Vernon Robinson. It was as harsh an editorial as I've ever seen.
Yeah, we really conked them. my column, which was on the opposing page, was a tongue-in-cheek endorsement of Vernon Robinson for various reasons that he probably would prefer not
one of the stated. One of the problems that I see is they're violating Ronald Reagan's 11th commandment: "Thou shall speak no evil of another Republican." They're just cutting each other open.
Yeah.
And it's hard to say how this will serve the Republicans.
Well, but I think that before we go any further with this, I think for those who don't live in the 5th Congressional District and don't hear the radio and TV ads there, I think we ought to give a flavor of what it has been like there in the Winston-Salem area. We'll start out here with Vernon Robinson. I believe this is his latest and perhaps least inflammatory by some people's measure. Least inflammatory attack on his opponent, Virginia Fox.
Vernon Robinson's a conservative, and you're a liberal. Vernon's never voted for a tax increase, but you voted to raise taxes and fees over 100 times. Vernon's never voted for racial quotas or special rights for homosexuals or the abortion pill, but you, Virginia Fox, you did. Vernon's never taken a contribution from the homosexual PACs or from John Edwards Academy of Trial Lawyers or the feminist PACs, but you, Virginia Fox, you did. Vernon never got a 100% approval rating from the ACLU or the liberal teachers' unions, but you did.
That is an ad for Vernon Robinson, one of the two Republicans running in the runoff tomorrow for the 5th Congressional District. Virginia Fox's opponent has been answering Vernon Robinson with ads of her own. Here's her latest.
The gospel, according to Vernon, everyone else is liberal, pro-homosexual, supports illegal aliens, pro-abortion, and downright bad. Ed Broyhill, Jay Helvey, Nathan Tabor, and Virginia Fox, all liberals, all dangerous, according to Robinson. Jay Helvey, says Robinson, has no regard for honesty and truth. Tabor says Robinson engages in vicious personal attacks which simply aren't true. Vernon Robinson is a dangerous liar.
Well, Paul O'Connor, you laugh. You've heard this kind of thing before.
Because
no?
He loves this.
This is really why, Melinda, this is why we got in this business and took the low paychecks for all these years for this kind of entertainment.
Well, is this the lowest road that you've heard in North Carolina politics?
Boy. Oh, no, there's plenty of tradition. If you want to win, you have to go negative. And if the other side goes negative, you have no choice but to respond in kind. They really are tearing each other apart, though, and they're doing the party a disservice.
The conventional wisdom is that you do have to go negative. I wonder if Fox didn't make a mistake, though, by not taking a higher road and laughing, maybe, or just talking about her credentials and what she will do for the 5th. That commercial sounded like a Vernon Robinson commercial, minus the Twilight Zone music that he likes to play.
Well, the problem with that would be very much out of Senator Fox's character. She's a feisty lady. She and I have had plenty of run-ins over the years. And I, to tell you the truth, I've got to laugh when I hear somebody calling her a liberal. I mean, she is one of the more conservative and really one of the more acerbic members of the Senate. And to see a race where she's being considered the mild-mannered person, and if she had tried to project herself as a mild-mannered person, I don't think it would have worked. This is a tough cookie, this woman.
Well, Ed Cohn?
It's interesting to me, too, that the complete disregard for actual objective fact that Robinson shows. When he says she voted for all these tax increases, I understand that she actually voted to allow local option voting on a tax increase, which is rather different. The ad that I saw last night during the Olympics that he's running shows this Pakistani national who was arrested in Charlotte and convicts him of being a terrorist. He came here to kill you, is what Vernon looked into the camera and said. The guy will just say anything.
Right, but objective fact doesn't necessarily always work its way into campaign ads. It's not a cornerstone of campaign ads.
It rarely does, it seems.
Yeah. I understand this is the most expensive congressional race in the country.
Yeah.
Why is that? Mike Munger, Paul O'Connor?
Well, it's an open seat, and for some reason, each of the two sides have been able to convince some people that they might win. So it's always going to have more spending when it's close.
And we haven't even gotten to the fall election.
Right. And it's an open seat. It's a seat that most people figured would be won in the Republican primary. And then in addition, you had, what was it, six or seven? I've lost track of how many we had in the first round, several of them millionaires several times over. So there was plenty of money in the pipeline. Remember also that Robinson does have a national following. He can tap into some conservative groups.
And where did he get the national following from?
He has built this up over the years by putting himself out as the Black Jesse Helms, which is, as I understand it, is a tag that we at the Winston-Salem Journal gave him first.
But he's been proud of it. And in fact, you have to recognize one of the things Jesse Helms did was galvanize a bunch of volunteers and contributors, as well as taking an ideological mantle.
Mm-hmm. And doing it nationally.
Also, in terms of the cost of this race, you have to look at the fact that since incumbent congressmen rarely lose, you win an open seat, you're in for, you know, Howard Coble's been in for 20 years in my district, so you amortize that $1 million over.
It's a good return on investment.
Yeah.
This is The State of Things. We're talking with Ed Cohn, Mike Munger, and Paul O'Connor, and our conversation continues in just a moment. 1-877-962-9862 is the number. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkava, and we're talking today at our roundtable about news and politics here in North Carolina. With us in the studio are Mike Munger, who is chair of the Political Science Department at Duke University, and Paul O'Connor, a columnist for the Winston-Salem Journal. On the phone, we have Ed Cohn, who's a writer and, among other things, an opinion columnist for the Greensboro News and Record and author of the blog, edcohn.com. And we're welcoming your calls this hour. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. If you have a question or comment about the way some of these races are shaking out in North Carolina, tomorrow, of course, is another election day, a primary runoff. Mm-hmm. We have two primary runoffs for Republicans in congressional races in the 5th and the 10th. And there is going to be a runoff among Democrats for superintendent of public instruction.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Cost, I understand, of the primary of this runoff is about $3 million.
About $3 million.
And some are suggesting maybe it's time to take a look at the whole idea of having runoffs after primaries.
Well, we've been looking at that idea about getting rid of runoffs for years, and I think I've probably written any number of times that we should get rid of them. I think I've changed my mind now, and I think the 5th district is a good example of why. The General Assembly, with legislative races both at the state and national level, has created ghettos of one party or the other. There are very, very small percentage, Mike, you might know this percentage better than I do, of congressional districts in the United States and in North Carolina are actually competitive on a partisan basis. That is Republican versus Democrat.
It's like 10 or 15%. It's a very small number.
So essentially what we could have had in the 5th district with six people running is someone winning the Republican nomination with 23 or 24%. I guess theoretically 18%.
Because Vernon Robinson got about 24%,
yeah,
Virginia
but,
Fox 22.
But theoretically we could have had it down to about 17 or 18%. They win that. And then there's no, because it's a solidly Republican district, there's no Democratic candidate, and they're getting elected to Congress with 18% of a primary vote. If we're going to have a one-party system, we have to have runoffs.
Mike Munger?
I think that may be true. There's a more complex system that we might use. Certainly, if you have that many people, you might end up picking someone who gets 23% as a first-place candidate, but 50 or 60% would have chosen someone else. An intermediate way of doing it would be to ask people to rank them. So of these six, choose number one, number two, number three. You could put it all on your ballot, and then you could just look at that ranking and see who would win if there's a runoff.
Mm-hmm. Is this all based on the presumption that because the district may be solidly Republican, there is no way that Republicans would look at that person who perhaps won the primary with only 18% and say, I can't do that. I may take a closer look at this Democrat.
Well, that would be fine. But if you
possible?
Have a Democrat registered to run, mm-hmm. Typically what happens in these districts is that you get only one party registering candidates, or the minor party in the district just is not able to draw a qualified candidate.
He's not qualified. He doesn't have any money. Mm-hmm. It's hard to raise any money.
Mm-hmm. And we have our first Democratic challenger to Howard Coble in the 6th district this time around, and he's running what might charitably be called a stealth campaign so far. Mm-hmm. I mean, there isn't any money, and there's no hope of him winning, and so the national party is not going to fund him.
And for an issue close to your heart, Ed Cohn, is the opponent for Howard Coble, does he have any kind of online presence?
Well, he doesn't. And to me, the internet is such an ideal tool for insurgents because, as Matt Gross, who was Dean's chief blogger, who's now under contract to work for Erskine Bowles, pointed out in my newspaper column yesterday, it's almost free. And if you don't have any money, free is good. Mm. And so the fact that this fellow, Will Jordan, doesn't have a web presence of any kind yet is disturbing to me. You can't just build an internet community overnight. You really have to start in advance. So, no, he doesn't. He hasn't really done much of anything that I can see.
1-877-962-9862 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. We're talking about politics here in North Carolina. There are the runoffs tomorrow. There is also a recent poll, the latest poll from WUNC Radio, WRAL-TV, and the News and Observer, shows in the presidential race, I want to shift to that right now, that John Kerry got a 2% bump from the Democratic convention, and now it appears that he trails George Bush by just 3%, 48% for Bush, 45% for Kerry in North Carolina. Kerry campaign appears to feel that North Carolina may be winnable. He's going to make an appearance in Charlotte later this week.
Well, if they do, good for them.
Do you think it's a good strategy for him, or well, can he win the state?
He could win the state. You could win the state. I could win the state. Who knows?
Probability here.
Yeah, but the odds are that he's not going to win the state. The hope, I think, of the Kerry people is to tie up some of the president's resources in North Carolina that keeps them out of the 18 or 19 combat states.
There's an open Senate seat here, too, and so mm-hmm. appearances by the guy at the top of the ticket are likely to help. There's no way that Kerry can win North Carolina, assuming best play by Bush, but it does require that Bush spend some time and some money in the state. North Carolina almost always polls 3-5% more Republican for national offices than you ever get out of polls. And I tried telling people that about Elizabeth Dole, that she was going to win by 10%. Everybody thought it was going to be too close to call. I don't know why that's true. It was true in all of Jesse Helms. It's a fact. For any national office, North Carolina polls much more Republican than you would get from the pre-election polls. It's not true for governor's races. It's not true for in-state offices.
What is it about people being polled who don't then reveal what their true intentions are at the national races?
The standard evaluation of that has always been that there are people down east who come from families that are Democrat who just refuse to tell anybody that they actually are voting Republican. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I buy that. That's basically the explanation of it.
Well, I'm a political scientist. We predict the past. I don't know anything about the future.
Thank you for that, Mike. Okay. Let's go to Mac, who joins us from Greensboro. Hi there, Mac.
Hello.
Hi. Did you have a comment for our guests?
Yes. I was thinking that the Democrats have a very good chance of winning North Carolina. I work in construction, and Democrats are rare as hen's teeth out here, and the Republicans that I talk to here on my job site, they're ready for a change. And I've been against the war from the onset. I'm a former Marine, and I think the general public, as more and more information comes out, and it becomes that's a real tragedy, and it's not a partisan, it's not a Republican Democratic issue. We had the same situation in Vietnam with Johnson, a Democrat in office. This war was fought for all the wrong reasons, and we didn't need to go in. And
is that the reason that your fellow workers on the construction site, the ones you describe as a Republican, are thinking of voting Democrat? Is it the war?
Yes, we talk about the war a lot out here. I had a former employee that had a brother in Iraq that was a master gunnery sergeant in the 101st Airborne, and I saw his mood change in over a matter of months, especially when his brother's tour of duty over there got extended, and he was back home and he's having some problems now, and I don't think they're physical problems. I think they're mental problems.
Ed Cohn?
Mac has something really important to say. I heard this the other day. I spoke to a group of retired businessmen at their lunch meeting in Greensboro, and afterwards a Republican gentleman came up to me and said, I can't vote for Bush because of this war. And I think as I was looking at that polling data, the negatives, the people who view Bush negatively, was the number that jumped out at me because, and I'm not a political scientist, but I think those numbers tend to only go up. I don't think people who think negatively of Bush now are going to think positively of him in November. However, more people might get into that category of thinking negatively about him by November. And that, I don't think, by the way, that Bush is going to lose North Carolina, but I do think those negatives are his problem more than the Kerry positives.
The Paul O'Connor?
Yeah, I agree with that. I am not going to go out on a limb and predict the state for either side. I've stayed out of that in my career. But I think that what our caller just discussed is out there. I've heard it. I've heard it from members of my family who were in the military who have a tendency to vote Republican, I believe, and they're voting Democratic this time. But I think that a lot of that is already factored in terms of North Carolina in this poll that we have. And it still says, you know, the margin of error in this poll, it's within the margin of error, but my suspicion is that this lead is actually 5 or 6 points in North Carolina, which is a competitive race in this state, which keeps the president from having coattails down for the other races that we may talk about a little bit later.
Yeah, there were two questions here I'd like to point out. This is from the most recent, you know, WUNC, WREL, and NNO poll. The question was, all in all, do you think the situation in Iraq was worth going to war over or not? 47% said yes, 45% no, just a 2% difference, 8% not sure. Other question, do you think that the war with Iraq has made the U.S. safer or less safe from terrorism? 47% again say safer, 45% say less safe. So statistically, you know, it's a draw.
It's a draw, yeah.
I think it would be a mistake to put too much emphasis on the war. It's going to come down to the economy. I think what Bush is worried about is the economy is not turned up nearly as much as he had expected. John Kerry's a very weak candidate. I think he's going to get just eaten up in ads. The ads may be unfair. There may be a mischaracterization, but he's out of the mainstream, and he's a flip-flopper because you can quote, it's always difficult to run as a senator because you have votes. You had to take positions, and you had to vote with your party sometimes. Mm-hmm. So
Now, which ads do you think are going to be more effective? Which Bush ads or pro-Bush ads against Kerry are going to be most effective, the ones that talk about his votes on Iraq or the Swift boat issue?
Well, the Swift boat one was just completely irresponsible. It's largely lies, and it's very effective. And so I think that they're going to be able to neutralize the war problem. A lot of people who are upset about the war, it's going to come down to this. George Bush has defied other nations when he thought it was in America's interest. We could debate whether it was or not. John Kerry won't do that. He defies America's interest in terms of satisfying other nations, and people are going to turn away from him because of that.
Mm-hmm.
My response to that would be I'm not so sure that the negative ads are going to work in the presidential race. There's negative ads on both sides. I was just reading a piece where the president is now out with ads that are very soft, and it's he and his wife sitting on a couch discussing some things. And the Republicans turned to those ads after spending something like $78 million trying to beat up John Kerry with negative ads. And they're still behind. And really, the polls haven't moved.
I think that's remarkable. Bush has had the worst 6 months of any president since Nixon. And the polls haven't moved.
The
so
polls
playing
haven't
defense
moved.
Worked.
Yeah, well, I also think that, that the public is, in large part, in the presidential race nationwide, made up its mind. Mm-hmm. And that's in the cooker, that it's pretty much decided.
So, Ed Cohn, we have 6 or 7 or 8% of North Carolina presidential race voters undecided. What's your take of what Kerry or Bush have to do to get those that 6 or 7%?
Well, I think the war is perhaps a larger issue than maybe other people in this conversation do. And I think it's a very fluid situation. I think a lot of people don't quite know what to believe. And if, you know, they capture Sadr or Osama, things look good. For Bush, one thing that's interesting to me, too, is that one of the great fears for the Democrats was that Kerry would have to spend all his money by spreading it over 4 months while Bush got to spend his over 3 because of the timing of the convention. But I haven't noticed that Bush has made a great move in August, which was the month where he had the great advantage.
Mm-hmm. And in North Carolina, is there anything in any issue in North Carolina where we might be different from the rest of the country to get at the swing voters in North Carolina and appeal to them different from what would happen nationally, Paul?
I would say the tobacco, the potential of a tobacco buyout has some potential with Bush supporters down east. The president made that comment in Cincinnati that he didn't really think we needed a change, and the Democrats jumped all over him. You wonder how a tobacco buyout would play down east if either the conference committee does reach agreement or if it doesn't, and somehow a combination of John Kerry and Erskine Bowles managed to lay that at the feet of the president.
But the president did come around on a buyout finally. I mean, he backed away from his earlier statement.
Well, you can say he flip-flopped on it then.
Do you think the Kerry campaign is going to say that? Is going to make hay out of that here?
Well, I would think that Erskine Bowles would.
But it seems to be hurting Burr already to have been perhaps not quite as enthusiastic as North Carolinians would have liked in support of that buyout program.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Richard Burr, of course, the Republican candidate for the Senate seat that John Edwards is vacating. Let's look at the race between Richard Burr and Erskine Bowles. Now, Erskine Bowles has aligned himself with the Kerry campaign, perhaps one of the reasons for the visit to Charlotte this week by Kerry. But Mike Easley, the governor, has not. He's been a no-show when Kerry Edwards' team came to town in Raleigh a couple of weeks ago. Why is that? Why is that? You know, you have Bowles, being at by Kerry's side, but Easley not. Mike Munger?
I think it's very hard to understand Mike Easley, and I think the easiest explanation is he's basically a pretty good guy, and he's kind of shy. He finds it fairly easy to speak on behalf of someone else, but self-promotion he finds difficult. And there just seems to be a kind of general cussedness that I think I would find admirable in a friend, but in a governor, people must just shake their heads a lot. Why isn't he more helpful? It's hard for me to imagine Easley losing, but Ballantyne has made really significant. He had in February of last year, 63% of people had no opinion. That's down to 19%.
Of Patrick Ballantyne, who's now the Republican running against Easley.
Yeah, and the result of that is that now his favorables are much, much higher.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I notice his negatives are still reasonably low. Of course, they've gone up as people have started to have an opinion of any sort about Ballantyne. And it struck me that this late primary that was supposed to hurt the Republicans so badly may help Ballantyne. He's a fresh face. He presents well. And not to say anything negative about him, but maybe between now and November, he won't have enough time to accrue enough negatives to be a problem.
Well, I think the reason it may have helped them was two things. Vinroot didn't win, and then he dropped out. Mm-hmm. So it, had it been late and there'd been this big, awful, ugliness that we're seeing in
a
the
primary
fifth district,
tomorrow between
yes,
the two.
Yes, where they've really been critical of each other, I think it'd be a different story.
The poll, there's someplace in the poll, there's a number that says 43% of the people still don't have a good idea of Ballantyne.
But the campaign hasn't started.
Okay. What I'm surprised by is that the governor, with this money that he has sitting around, hasn't used this time to define Patrick Ballantyne in the eyes of the North Carolinian voter.
Is he just playing a game of ignoring him?
He hates politics. Yeah. He would rather not do it. And actually, he would rather just have an appointed position than an elected one.
Mike Easley is an enigma to those of us who follow politics. He's really unlike anybody we've ever had to deal with.
Is it partly because he doesn't allow much access to reporter types?
No, I mean, his access is fine. I mean, if you see, heck, I ran into him once at Cameron Village. I mean, he'll sit and talk to you at any time. I mean, he's not bad. He just doesn't like crowds. And he likes to spend the weekends at the beach. And he's just an oddball, I guess, is a way of putting it.
Well, we'll continue with our analysis of the governor and more about politics here in North Carolina with Paul O'Connor, Mike Munger, and Ed Cohn. All that coming up in just a moment. And we'll get to more of your calls. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. On the state of things. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava, and today we're talking about political news here in North Carolina. There is a runoff election tomorrow. Yes, in the middle of August, the polls will be open for two congressional runoffs. That's among Republicans and for the Democrat who would be the candidate in the fall for the superintendent of public instruction. With us to talk about all of this is Paul O'Connor, columnist for the Winston-Salem Journal, Mike Munger, who is chair of the political science department at Duke University, and journalist Ed Cohn is with us. He is, among other things, opinion columnist for the Greensboro News and Record and author of the blog edcohn.com. We're taking your calls. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. We were just before the break talking about Governor Easley, and I think you were suggesting that he was shy about crowds.
Yeah, he just doesn't appear to like crowds. I find Mike Easley so interesting because he really is one of the best person-to-person politicians I've ever known. He's a charming guy. He's fun. He remembers a little something about everybody. I can remember once being on a debate panel, and he was debating Harvey Gantt. And after the debate, I had my son with me, who at that time was about 5 or 6 years old. And whereas Gantt reached down and shook the hand of this little guy, Mike Easley got right down on eye level with him. And, you know, that may help Mike Easley. He may get a vote from that six-year-old because he's 21 now, you know, and he remembers. But he just knows how to deal with people one-on-one. But boy, in a crowd, he just seems to want to avoid them, even though he's a very good speaker.
I would say shy may be unfair. He's private, and that's just something more of what he liked. He got a bad draw because Patrick Ballantyne is someone that loves crowds, always like to jump into the middle of it and shake hands. And this may be a bad matchup. Even though Ballantyne is way behind on money, he might be able to make Easley look bad if he can do enough retail campaigning.
Yeah, what are the issues that you think Ballantyne is going to make in the race?
Ballantyne's first issue is business development that is based first on the corporate income tax being too high and this notion that he has that North Carolina is doing very badly in the creation of jobs. This is where Easley has a wonderful counterstroke in that he has a couple of studies showing that North Carolina has got one of the top tax burdens in the country in terms of how low the total tax burden is.
Mm-hmm. It's a favorable tax burden.
Favorable is a good way of saying it. Yeah. Most favorable tax burden for business. And Ballantyne wants to cut the corporate income tax.
Mm-hmm. Of course, in the GOP primary for being the gubernatorial candidate, all of the candidates seem to be making an issue of what they saw as giveaways to large companies, that the governor signed the checks to keep this company here, keep that company here, companies that they maintain didn't even need those tax breaks.
I don't believe Ballantyne can make that issue, because I believe he voted for some of those.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the poll that the latest poll has Easley with 51% to Ballantyne's 35%, 14% undecided, and we're a couple, 3 months out from the race. Last week, the governor, speaking of helping industries, $2 million for a NASCAR test track, and at the same time signing a bill that made NASCAR glam plates, vanity plates, in North Carolina.
This is an industry that the state is scared to death is going to somehow move out of here. I can't tell the difference between, you know, Roger Clemens and Bobby Labonte. You know, so I know absolutely nothing about NASCAR.
But there goes your shot at governor.
Thank God.
You may get fired from the paper.
Maybe I shouldn't have said that over the air.
But, your cred has just gone down the drain there.
But I will. Our listeners need to know, Melinda, that you and I grew up just about in the same place in Connecticut,
two towns over
from each other. But the point is that they're scared to death that they're going to lose this industry, that somebody's going to be able to lure it away. There are those. John Hood at the John Locke Foundation, who says that this is not an industry that can easily pick up and move, that it's got personal family roots here. The drivers all live here. Their families live here. Mm-hmm. That it's not going to move, but they're making this investment. And I think it is a legitimate issue to be discussed.
And we have seen, when we've done programs on this, we have seen a number of the races leave North Carolina. While you may have the industry based around the Charlotte area, you know, Rockingham and other tracks are no longer, you know, being used, right, Ed Cohn?
Sadly, that is the case. And, we could do a whole week on NASCAR. I think it's a sport that, like so many other sports, has a real danger of losing touch with its fans as it becomes multinational in its dreams. And Ed Hardin, the columnist for the News and Record, sports columnist, had a great column yesterday about its focus on supporting its advertisers at the expense of just about everything else. Nevertheless, it is an indigenous industry. People here love it. And I think that investing in a test track and putting it on the vanity plates probably was pretty smart politics.
Okay. Let's go to Thomas in Chapel Hill. Hi there, Thomas.
How are you doing?
Fine. Welcome to the show.
I've got a comment about the presidential politics. And, you know, the one thing I've noticed about Bush, I mean, somebody in there made the comment they would beat Kerry up so bad. Bush is an incumbent, and I do politics for a living. And I've never seen an incumbent win who can't first run on his record. And I don't see Bush running on his record. The closest thing I've seen was about a week ago in front of a crowd where he said he's running for president because he wants to make a great economy a better economy. I don't think that passes a smell test. I don't think anybody believes that this is a great economy, nor has it been a great economy since he's been in office.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mike Munger?
The models... that if you use the performance of the economy and the fact that Bush is an incumbent, the predictions that I've seen is that nationwide Bush will get 57% or 58%, and if there's no way you can distribute that, so it's not a pretty large victory in the electoral college. Now, it's possible if the economy continues to turn down, or if those models are just wrong, because like I said, we're predicting the past, it'll be different. I think that everybody in Chapel Hill talks to each other and says, you know, we hate Bush, and we all do. And so they get this sense that everyone else does too. And it's not true. You look at the polls, that's all factored in already. And I think it's remarkable that Bush's negatives basically haven't gone up in the last year.
Well, because of the economy?
The model you're talking about is that econometrics model that comes out of Yale.
Ray Fair's model.
Yeah.
In yesterday's New York Times.
Yeah, I saw it in Esquire, I think. Huh. And we're going to hide our bias, New Haven bias, against Yaleys. But what that model is saying is that this economy is in good shape. I think that's hard to believe for the hundreds of thousands of people who are out of work, and for the fact that this 4-year term of president has not produced any new jobs. for a growing population. I just don't buy that econometric model.
Yeah, well, to bring this back to North Carolina, we have the 10th congressional district race. I've seen it reported that the 10th congressional district considered among the most blue-collar districts in the country.
It's the most heavily industrial manufacturing
in the country.
In the country.
So presumably it would have taken a hit with the industries, yes. The manufacturing jobs going overseas. Yet that does not appear to be what the issue is that the candidates are talking about in tomorrow's runoff in the among Republicans in the 10th congressional district. It's not the economy that seems to have resonated, at least according to the ads that
it's a very conservative district, and you have an old-line conservative sheriff, Mr. Huffman, running against kind of a neocon, new Republican.
Movement Republican, I call him.
Okay. His name is Patrick McHenry. Patrick looks younger than most high schoolers. I mean, I've been around him.
Younger than Ralph Reed looks.
He is 28, and he literally looks 18. And he served one term in the General Assembly, but he's got this resume of 2 years at any number of different stops in the political ladder. And he's coming after Mr. Huffman with direct mail and very aggressively.
But the issues are not jobs lost. The issues apparently are the socially cultural conservative issues,
right.
Gay marriage, God in the schools, abortion,
which is red meat in a Republican primary.
Mike Munger, are you surprised by that?
I'm distressed by it. It seems like the Taliban wing of the Republican Party is starting to dominate these sorts of elections, and it's a dangerous thing for the party. They're not talking about issues that a lot of people care about. What they're talking about, the turnout may be 12% tomorrow, and so if you can get 6.5% of the district, you can win. And so they want to galvanize people who are upset.
But Ed Cohn, does that really matter in the long run? Because a win on the Republicans' column is a win in the Republicans' columns, regardless of whether you're a moderate Republican, liberal Republican, conservative Republican.
I think it matters. I thought at the state convention in Greensboro earlier this year, when they wouldn't let the log cabin Republicans set up their table, I think they're pushing away a lot of people who might otherwise be interested in voting for them, and you can perhaps win a seat for a cycle or two, but if you take people for granted, they're going to remember it. And that's what the Winston-Salem Journal article was saying yesterday, that the only person who could possibly win the fifth, for example, for the Democrats would be Vernon Robinson.
Well, we shall see. We'll have to come back sometime after tomorrow's runoffs. Thank you all for being here today.
Thank you.
Thanks
for
having me.
Thanks to Ed Cohn, who is a journalist, who is also an opinion columnist to the Greensboro News and Record and author of the weblog at edcohn.com. He's also helping organize the Piedmont Bloggers Conference this Saturday in Greensboro. Thanks to Paul O'Connor, columnist for the Winston-Salem Journal, and Mike Munger, chair of the Political Science Department at Duke University. The Dell Computer Corporation is considering putting a large new manufacturing plant in Greensboro. This new plant could bring thousands of skilled jobs to a region that's been reeling from the demise of the textile and furniture industries. Justin Catanoso, executive editor of the Triad Business Journal, has been weighing the economic factors as Greensboro tries to land the Dell plant.
6 years ago, a favorite parlor game of journalists in this region was handicapping the competition for the proposed Federal Express air cargo hub and its 1,500 jobs. Sure, other locations were in the running with the Triad, but once you laid all the known and neutral factors on the table, like the fact that the Triad had an underused airport, plenty of cheap labor, and four interstates crossing through it, one thing became clear. The Triad was going to have to screw up pretty badly to lose that economic development prize. Well, it didn't. And FedEx will open its long-delayed hub at Piedmont Triad International in 2009. Now, 6 long years and 25,000 lost manufacturing jobs after that FedEx coup, the Triad finds itself again in the hunt for a major economic development trophy, a huge Dell computer-making plant and the promise of nearly 2,000 skilled jobs. This time, it seems, the Triad is only in competition with itself. The world's largest maker of personal computers appears to favor a location somewhere in the region. That doesn't mean that people here should start icing bottles of champagne. Requests for more than $100 million in state and local incentives could fall through. where that money could fail to satisfy Dell's determination to find the lowest cost location. But barring some unforeseen calamity, the known and neutral factors once again seem to heavily favor the Triad landing this mega project. Here's why. A recent University of California at Irvine study lays out 5 points behind Dell's business rationale for major expansion decisions. Let's take them one at a time. Number one, market access. Dell has 2 domestic computer making plants right now. The first is in its hometown of Austin, Texas, a central location to the entire U.S. 5 years ago, it opened a plant in Nashville to better serve the East Coast. Dell now says that demand is surging, especially in the Mid-Atlantic, and that more production capacity is needed. Advantage, Triad, which is in the heart of the Mid-Atlantic. Number two, labor costs. Dell operates in Texas and Tennessee largely because labor costs there are cheaper than on the West Coast, where so many computer and software giants are clustered. Dell also likes regions with little or no union activity and lots of experienced manufacturing workers. Well, labor costs in the Triad are lower than both Texas and Tennessee. Union activity is nil, skilled workers are abundant. Advantage, Triad. Number three, transportation. Dell founder and chairman Michael Dell himself says logistics is a bigger cost than labor. As a result, location and roads are critical to any expansion decision. Dell put a plant in Nashville partly because of its interstate access and proximity to a FedEx Air cargo hub in Memphis. The Triad sits at the nexus of 4 interstates and will have its own FedEx hub in 5 years. Advantage, Triad. Number four, industry clusters. Dell doesn't like to locate in places that already have a lot of computer manufacturing. Labor markets are too tight there. They don't need to be near major research universities, which drive up costs, and they don't require suppliers to be nearby, as long as parts can be shipped in quickly and easily. Once again, advantage, Triad. And finally, number five, government incentives. This is the all-important wild card with no distinct advantage. Because of its low-cost business model, Dell demands plenty in incentives. Things like free land, worker training programs, property tax abatements, utility discounts, you name it. North Carolina is not known to lavish incentives on corporations. As a result, automakers such as BMW and Mercedes-Benz headed elsewhere in the past, leaving North Carolina a distant second for those costly and lucrative projects. These days, what Governor Easley and his Commerce Department are preparing to offer Dell is anyone's guess. Here in the Triad, business leaders, mindful of just how far the textile, tobacco, and furniture industries have fallen, are hoping that the governor digs deep and figures out a way to land this important and much-needed project. The fact is, lesser deals have fallen apart over less demanding incentives. But when you step back and consider what Dell needs and what the Triad has to offer, it suddenly feels like 1998 and the battle for FedEx all over again. In other words, this Dell deal isn't done yet. But here in the Triad, things look pretty darn good.